Soul Talk Podcast is your guide to all things wellness. On this podcast, you'll find many episodes with the scope and focus on health, wellness, and life. Welcome to episode 53 of Soul Talk Podcast. Episode 53 is Investigating Psychedelics for Mental Health with Dr. Catherine Leedon, who I refer to in this episode as Kat. And Kat is a clinical research fellow at Trinity College Dublin and is part of many different psychedelic research groups. And works with Dr. John Kelly and Professor Andrew Harkin and many others. In the day-to-day of Kat's work, she's primarily investigating the use of psychedelics for specific mental health conditions that haven't responded to typical treatments such as depression, anorexia, and PTSD. So have a wee listen to the episode to learn more. Welcome to the podcast, Kat.
Thanks so much for having me, Carla.
You're welcome. So I'm looking forward to hearing about your work with psilocybin research, how you got here, what you've been up to, and how you ended up in this field. I wanted to say in two things, first of all. So I know you were very careful to let me know that this work is investigational and not approved for treatment. So I'll disclaim that up front. And the other thing that I want to disclaim is that I will be speaking on very simple terms. I don't know about you, but I will be speaking on very simple terms on this episode because I am not a doctor or an expert in this field. So bear with me. And I'm sure the listeners would appreciate that in general, just so that they can understand it from a normal stance as opposed to doctoral terms and stuff. But do your thing, and anything I don't understand, I'll ask you just to break it down. I would like to start by just asking you to do a wee intro into yourself and tell me a wee bit about who Kat is.
Sure. So thanks again for having me. My name is Catherine Leedon. I go by Kat, to those who know me. So I'm a medical doctor by profession, but I like to, you know, say I work as a doctor. I it's not who I am, it's what I do. I have a background working in social care, and I studied psychology previously. So I've had an interest in the mind, consciousness, how people want to explore their states of consciousness, and how altered states of consciousness can affect people in their everyday life. And I suppose I've just always been interested in things like substance use, addiction, as well as mental health. So I think all those things are quite intertwined. So aside from being a doctor or working as a doctor, I also have other varied interests. I think that I've seen a lot through my work in social care of people using substances in ways that can be damaging, and I've seen it in my personal life too, of, you know, attending music festivals and things like that. So I've somehow managed to weave some threads together with that, and I'm part of a group called PsyCare Ireland, so we're a welfare and harm reduction group. And I also DJ at music festivals, and I'm very passionate about making these spaces safer and more inclusive. And recently, I've been part of a newly starting collective called Shimmer, and I've been asked to DJ even just next week. Actually, I'll be DJing at a sober rave, so I'm trying to, you know, for me, all of this is connected. My love of music is very much an integral part of my life as well, and music festivals are often spaces where people do experiment with substances. And one thing that I would just add as a disclaimer is that psychedelic substances, even though we are investigating them for potential benefits in terms of people's mental health, they're not actually for everybody, and they can be very confronting. They can bring people to very challenged states of mind when taken in unsupported settings or when a person's mental health's already challenged. So I just wanted to say that as well. But that's me in a nutshell, really.
Okay, thank you. So yeah, your background in psychology, so you work with mental health, people with mental health difficulties, addiction, and homeless people as well. And then from that, you've now transitioned more into psychedelic research. And I know that there's going to be, I know you're working on different trials that you, and there's different things that you will and will not be able to talk about. Can you talk to me a wee bit about just where you're at now, what you're currently working on, and then we'll get a wee bit more specific.
Sure, yeah. So my current role is I'm a clinical research fellow at Trinity College Dublin. So I am part of a psychedelic research group at Trinity. And my specific role, the one that's involved, I'm involved with clinical trials, investigating the use of psychedelics. So we're using psilocybin, 5-MeO-DMT, as well as we'll be starting a new trial using methadone for people with mental health conditions such as depression, anorexia, and PTSD, or post-traumatic stress disorder. So that's where I'm at now, really. And other parts of my job, I'm part of other research that's going on. I'm also currently investigating presentations to the emergency department and looking at cases where people present as a result of alcohol or other substance use. So it's quite a varied role, really. But I suppose the day-to-day part of my job is mostly seeing patients, or seeing participants who are taking part in these research trials.
And you also so your work with Inward Bound as a which is an Irish psilocybin retreat organization, part of your work with them is to help with the screening process you were saying to me before. And what so how do you determine who's medically and psychologically fit to take part in the trials?
So it depends. Like, each trial will have their own inclusion and exclusion criteria, and it's quite specific depending on what the substance is, really. Generally speaking, about suitability, like it would, it wouldn't be advised for someone whose physical health is unstable. Certain chronic conditions might mean that someone might be at increased risk. And it depends on the psychedelic in question as well, because some of these substances, they can induce changes. Like, they can, for example, be strenuous, or they might induce a state of stress that might not be advisable for someone, say, who had a history of heart problems, for example. That's just one example. Now, there are many, many, many examples. It also depends on the mental health condition that the person has. For example, one of the trials is working with people with eating disorders, and specifically anorexia nervosa. And that is actually the most deadly mental health condition in terms of mortality or deaths, because being chronically undernourished can put a lot of strain on a person's body, in particular the heart. So we have particular restrictions around, around medical things that we look for that are very common in anorexia. So we can only accept participants with, who are at a certain body mass index, which is, it's a number that represents the person's weight proportionately to their height, if that makes sense. And it's not a perfect measure, but it's one marker that we use of safety. So then, psychologically, just to answer the other part of your question, so understandably, we're working with people who have mental health difficulties. And I think that it is amazing that this is happening. However, we also have to be very careful not to destabilize people, or to make their mental health worse. So with that in mind, each person, there are different investigations in terms of questionnaires, and I would do a full psychiatric or mental health history interview with each person who comes on. And if the risk is deemed too high, for example, if somebody was really feeling very, very low, or if they were having thoughts of say harming themselves or ending their life, for example, that would be something that, you know, would be a barrier to them taking part. And it isn't that these thoughts are completely unacceptable and that you could never take psychedelics, but it's just in particular that we have to bear in mind that if someone, you know, within a certain time frame, taking a psychedelic can put someone at risk if they've had those thoughts or feelings in recent history, if that makes sense. And the other thing, just to say, and I mentioned that psychedelics aren't for everybody, and there are many people even who take psychedelics recreationally, who might have a history of, say, their mood might have been very, very high at one point in their life. That's often described as like a manic episode, which is associated with bipolar disorder. So where someone's mood kind of swings very high, and then they might have low periods as well. So for people who have manic episodes, there is some evidence to show that that psychedelics can induce a manic episode in people who have a history of that. And there are a number of kind of cases documented in the scientific literature as well of that. So they're the kinds of things I look out for. And just another thing to state specifically, like, understandably, you know, I think when people think about psychedelics, they might think about like bright colors or hallucinations, like as in seeing things that maybe they wouldn't see in their everyday life, you know, and those images can be beautiful. However, they can be kind of, while they're different to, say, hallucinations that you might associate it with something like a psychosis or schizophrenia, there is not enough evidence at the moment to say that psychedelics are safe in people who have a history of psychosis or schizophrenia. So for that reason, they're not recommended for people with that diagnosis, or for people who have a first degree family member who have a history of psychosis or schizophrenia. So it's they're the kind of specific inclusion exclusion type of things that come up, and again, all of that is readily available information. It's scientifically driven, it's evidence-based. The other thing that I really look out for, and these would be discussions that I'd have with potential participants very early on, would be around their expectations. And managing expectations can be a really important part of the job, because as these are scientific trials, they're taking place in very, very controlled environments. And again, maybe I should have said this at the start, but it's, you know, it's supported by professionals. It's done in a legal setting where, you know, we have licenses to carry out this work. And it's regulated as well, and there's oversight from regulatory bodies as well. So a key part of working in clinical trials is that it's a scientific environment. It's done in very controlled settings, and the trials that we're completing in Tala Hospital are double blind placebo controlled trials. So what that means is that the people involved in the trial who are running the study, and that includes me and the participants, we don't know what dose of whatever substance it is the person is receiving. It also means that these trials are placebo controlled, so there is a control group in the study as well. So, just for example, in certain trials, there might be a ratio of 50-50 placebo versus active dose of a drug. So that would mean that 50% of participants who enroll in the study will receive placebo, and the other 50% will receive an active dose of the drug. So that's just a hypothetical example there. So, and the reason for that is because we need to be able to say, or we need to be able to say that any changes that we might see in a person's illness or their mental health is definitely due to the intervention or the substance or the psychedelic assisted therapy, really. So that can be tricky sometimes, you know, and a part of my job will be trying to understand if a person can actually tolerate that uncertainty and tolerate the process of going through the trial, if that makes sense.
So in terms of psilocybin trials and research, and your area of expertise is working with people who have mental illnesses and anorexia and stuff like that. And what other illnesses or people would be would psilocybin potentially be a good fit for, in your professional opinion?
Sure. So I suppose it's important to acknowledge that psilocybin has a really, really long history of being used in non-clinical settings. And I think that, the medicalization of these things is potentially a wonderful thing because it means that more people will have access. However, it isn't necessarily only people who have a mental health difficulty who could potentially benefit. For example, Inward Bound is an organization that you mentioned, and they actually don't take people who have a mental health condition. And the reason for that is because while their facilitators are very well trained in how to support somebody in an altered state of consciousness, there wouldn't be enough support at a retreat group setting, in a group setting on a retreat, say, to support somebody who had higher needs. And also just to say that those retreats don't take place in Ireland, even though it's an Irish group, they take part in the Netherlands, they take place in the Netherlands, where it is legal to do so. So yeah, it depends. And the ceremonial use of psilocybin has been going on for thousands of years, as far, well, now obviously the evidence for that can be hard to prove, but even one of the founders of Inward Bound, Rob Coffey, is very experienced in this area. He's a psychotherapist and a transpersonal therapist, and he gave a very interesting talk at Breaking Convention, which is a psychedelic science conference in Exeter. He gave a talk last year in 2023 about how there's preliminary evidence of psilocybin use in Ireland, actually. So going back a very long time, before Christianity was even in the country, he presented evidence of that. So in terms of other specific conditions where people might benefit from psilocybin, there is some very interesting research. Now, there has been some research done in the past on using it for people who have terminal illnesses, and actually the European Union have just granted a very large grant. I can't remember the exact amount, but I can forward you on the article later for anyone who's interested. They've granted money for centres all over Europe to research how psilocybin might help someone deal with a terminal diagnosis of, say, motor neuron disease, which is also known as ALS, or there are some other indications like certain forms of cancer and things like that. So I think that it has a lot of promise, really, across a range of conditions. And the literature, it's important not to overgeneralize, and it's also important not to overhype the benefits of psychedelics, but the literature does seem to suggest that the way that psychedelics work in the brain can be useful across multiple conditions, and that it may change how we treat mental health conditions in the future. It could potentially revolutionize psychiatry, although I strongly suspect that there will still be a role for talking therapies and other substances like antidepressants and things like that, and antipsychotics for some people. So it's just great to have an opportunity to expand our toolkit and to offer people a wider range of treatments.
And is the use of psilocybin for people with motor neurons and those different illnesses, is that to help on a mental level or a physical level or both, or?
That's a really good question. So, on a psychological or like a mental level, death anxiety is, of course, an incredibly challenging thing to deal with. Like if you're given a terminal diagnosis, so it is hoped that psilocybin may help promote a state of acceptance and a sense of connectedness to there being something greater than us, greater than our individual story. Like, you're born, you live, and you die, and that's it. And if that is your belief system, and you receive a terminal diagnosis, it's understandably like incredibly impactful and very scary. So we hope that it'll help with that. But the other thing to say as well is that the physical impact of psychedelics has also been researched. For example, at the Trinity Psychedelic Research Group, there is research ongoing into the anti-inflammatory effects and the immune modulating effects of psychedelics. So, for example, there is some research going on with a postdoctoral researcher, Guillaume Thury, and a PhD student, Christopher Sheridan, who I work with, and they're looking us together. We're going to be looking at how psilocybin and other psychedelics might affect immune markers in the blood, for example, of people with depression and people without depression. So it is very interesting, and I think that there is going to be this area of research is going to be ongoing and very active for quite some time.
Yeah, so my understanding of psilocybin and how it actually works in the brain and all that comes from watching Netflix documentaries, to be honest. And I've been to a few sea talks. I'm not sure if you're aware of sea talks. They
Yeah, I've heard
run,
of them.
yeah. So they're actually running a psychedelic online program at the minute for 6 weeks. I didn't sign up to it. I was tempted to just to learn more about it. I've been learning about, the default mode network in the brain and how it connects different parts and all of that. But that's about as probably as far as my knowledge goes. Talk to me, Kat, about what actually happens in the brain or to a person when psilocybin is in their system.
Sure. So on like a brain level, you mean?
Yeah, just whatever your area is. Yeah, I think like from a brain perspective, I think it would be really nice to understand exactly what it does to the brain, if that's okay.
Sure, yeah. So psilocybin, we know that it interacts with certain neurotransmitters in the brain. So neurotransmitters are chemical messengers. Some neurotransmitters or chemical messengers are associated with things like regulation of mood, regulation of sleep, appetite, for example, and plenty of other, bodily functions. And we know that many of these things, are changed in people with mental health conditions. And it's not just about bodily functions, it's about how we feel and how we experience the world as well. So specifically, psilocybin acts on what's called the serotonin 2A receptor. So it's the 5-HT, which is for serotonin, and then 2A receptor. Now there are other mechanisms, but that does seem to be the one that is generally focused on in the research. It basically, it acts on that receptor, and that is the way in which it's proposed to induce changes in perception of, visual stimuli or visual, causing visuals that people might report, as well as, altered emotions, really, really enhanced colors, or they might get like a crossover of their senses called synesthesia. So, things like, they might hear color, for example, or feel music, which is really interesting. So that's kind of on a very specific like receptor level, I suppose. Yeah, so I suppose like in a way that might be helpful to, any person to understand about like how do psychedelics work in the brain. There has been some research to show that psychedelics can help different parts of the brain that don't usually communicate to communicate, and it can increase overall connectivity between different parts of our brain. And that also can explain why people might have that crossing over of senses that I just described there. And the way that it's often described for people, you know, when they're trying to understand what might they expect from a psychedelic experience, an analogy I've often heard used would be about, let's say, imagine your daily patterns or your routines or your way of responding to issues or challenges that you might face in your everyday life. So if you imagine the those patterns as almost like tracks in snow. So let's say you've been like skiing, or you know, and there's like certain tracks that are very well established. The tendency of our brain is to follow those same tracks and patterns, or pathways in how to handle things or how to react to things. And they say that psilocybin can be akin to having a fresh blanket of snow over that, so that instead of maybe responding to a stressful situation the same way, it might be that another alternative is suddenly available. So I suppose that's kind of, it's a very kind of imagery based way of explaining it, but yeah, that they're kind of the mechanisms. There is plenty more research on that, and again, I'm not a neuroscientist, and the research that I do actually doesn't use neuroimaging, but that would be how I would describe it to patients.
I love that analogy, actually. That's really nice. Yeah, and so the work that you do and the work that you would be researching and trialing and stuff, I assume would be on a macrodose level. Is that right?
Yes, yeah.
Can you talk to me a bit about microdosing? Now, I know that microdosing it's become quite popular, and there's lots of different benefits, and you know, again, I can listen to this and watch this on Netflix and different podcasts and that sort of thing, but I'm really interested in hearing your opinion on microdosing if you're able to share that with me.
Sure. Like I think anecdotally, I have heard many reports, like online, for example, of people who find microdosing very beneficial. However, it's worth bearing in mind that there is a significant placebo response to consider there. And that just means that, like, if someone thinks that they're ingesting something that's going to help with their everyday functioning, there's an increased chance that it will, right? And the placebo effect is a very real effect. I sometimes would be of the opinion that, you know, if someone comes to me and they're like, oh, I'm trying this for my mental health or for my physical health, depending on what it is, like, once it's not doing the person any harm, once it's not doing another person any harm, if it's helpful to them, you know, I don't deny their experience if they say that it's helping them. The literature, on the other hand, would say that there isn't a very large evidence base for the effectiveness of microdosing. And you know, one of the things that I think is an issue with studying it is, firstly, as I mentioned, the placebo effect, but also the fact that, you know, to study that, you'd have to study people in their everyday lives. You know, the only way maybe that, like, I am yet to see a very controlled study, like where they had people maybe all living under the exact same conditions and all receiving the same microdose of the same substance and things like that. So the data just isn't really clear at the moment, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. I suppose even from the trial perspective, you know, is it a fair test if that takes me back to my school science days? Is it a fair test if the participants are all in the same controlled environment because they're being taken away from their external stressors and environments and stuff, and they're all in this safe place, you know? But I know that that's the only way that it could be done, like where it can be monitored and everyone can be safe and stuff. But do you consider that in the research that it's maybe not a fair test as such? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that's actually it's an interesting question, but I think that like because the psychedelic experience that participants undergo in a trial, you know, we're not using microdoses, so people aren't taking them every day. They might have like one session and it might last for several hours, for example, but then they'll go home, do you know? And it's like the actual psychoactive duration or the kind of the real like mind altering or mind manifesting part of it is all done in the controlled environment. But the results and you know, when people do take psychedelics, they often report that the benefits might not happen the first day. The first day could be really, really challenging for them, but it might be later on after the experience has passed that they might gain new insights into their life or into their emotions or into their relationships or other maybe issues that they might have in their life, for example. So yeah, I think the controlled environment is really, really necessary, in this, and particularly from a safety perspective, because we're working with people who do have mental health difficulties. So I think it is a fair test. Now, how we measure the outcome of psychedelic experiences may be a challenge, you know, like for example, it's one thing if we were doing a study and we were looking at you know, like lab results or something, and you can say for sure that like objectively this number of cells have increased between, you know, before they had the dose and after the dose. That would be one thing because you can say that's fairly objective. But when it comes to like somebody's mental health or how severe their symptoms are, a lot of the time you're relying on what the person is able to tell you as well, you know, so like measuring the subjective experience. And then of course, bearing in mind, like the word ineffable is often used to describe psychedelic experiences. Many people even struggle to put into words what they have experienced. So it can be hard to assess like the magnitude or the, you know, the intensity of those effects. And that also comes back to what you were saying about the macro dose. A good chunk of our patients will receive placebo, but we actually won't know for sure what our patients receive for quite some time until after the studies have closed and the data has been all analyzed. And you know, the mind is a very, very powerful thing. So you know, we won't be able to, like, even after a participant finishes the trial with us, we still can't 100% say for certain that they actually received a psychoactive dose, even if their mental health has improved significantly and even if they've had you know, very intense experiences on the day.
Wow. How long would they be in trial for per participant?
It depends. All of the trials that we're running are actually listed on clinicaltrials.gov, which I sent to you earlier. So they vary. Some of them are 6 months, give or take if, you know, a few weeks. Some of them are over a year.
And they would be there the whole time?
No. So the what usually happens is that, you know, a participant might come to us via their GP, their psychiatrist, or in some cases, maybe a therapist might refer. That's only really for a couple, one of the studies, actually. And they come in for outpatient appointments. So they'll come in and see myself and my colleagues who are, you know, the research team, and
Okay.
they'll go home. So the longest anyone would ever spend in with us in our clinic in Sheaf House, which is attached to adjacent to Tallaght Hospital, would be maybe 10 hours. That would be the dosing day for some of the trials. That would be the longest day.
Okay. Not 6 months or 1 year.
No.
Talk to me a wee bit more about the altered states of consciousness, like what people might expect to see, what they might report seeing, from a sort of positive, inverted commas, positive or negative, experience. So obviously, I'm sure there's a lot of people dealing with trauma and stuff that a lot's coming up for them, and it's maybe not such a nice process. And then other people, as you say, see colors and can hear colors and things like that. Just talk to me a wee bit about that and what people typically report or what you expect to see.
Sure. So again, like just speaking in general, because like, as I mentioned, it wouldn't be fair for me to discuss specific cases, but in general, the range of psychedelic experiences is really varied, and sometimes people have experiences that are very much related to their own life story. So it might be that they're working on, or they might be dealing with during the trip, their relationship with the parent, for example, and there'll be like different themes of that that'll come up through the trip, and it might be related to them by images or maybe even visual memories of different things, or it might all be bodily sensations, for example. It might be like, they might be feeling really sad, or they might have like a heaviness in their body, and sometimes those feelings are not always the way that we would typically experience emotions. So for example, people can feel sometimes like even a blanket that's on top of them can feel really, really heavy, and they might be like snuggling away into it one minute, and then they might be like, no, I can't deal with this, I want to be light and free, so it's the experience can change quite quickly for people. And then let's say another example, sometimes people report experiences where they feel in touch with, and I touched on this earlier, a sense of something maybe greater than this world, this reality that we experience in our everyday lives. Sometimes people report kind of a sense of connection to nature, for example, or it might alter their beliefs about like religion, spirituality, the existence of a god or gods, which is really fascinating. So it really, really depends. And for some people, they come through the experience, they might have a few intense emotional experiences, and some intensely, that includes happy ones, sad ones, difficult ones, anger. It wouldn't be unusual for people to want to dance during a psychedelic experience, or maybe shout or scream. So yeah, it's really, really, really varied. And in our trials, we try to create a safe space to allow that to unfold in a supported way. So the trials that we're doing with psilocybin, for example, would have trained psychotherapists who are there in the room the whole time to support the person through the experience.
And is there an out that was actually going to be my next question, so that you led in nicely there. Are psychotherapists, is psychotherapy a modality there too, or is it just that the psychotherapists are there to support?
So because we're investigating whether psilocybin can help people, it's not psychotherapy in the traditional sense. There are preparation sessions with a trained psychotherapist who's also trained in supporting people, and they would have integration sessions. And integration is a really key part of looking at what the person has experienced in a psychedelic session and how to implement that into their life, like the teachings, the learnings. So yeah, it's not really traditional psychotherapy as such, but the purpose of these trials is to investigate whether this could be helpful. And at so if this ever gets approved in Ireland, and the research team, we're hopeful that that will happen in the next several years. We can't, it's hard to put a timeline on that, but the way that the therapy looks may change hugely. It may well end up that the person ends up with a lot of therapy, if that makes sense. So just what we're doing now is kind of to as scientifically as we can to examine whether or not psilocybin with therapy can help.
Just on that, it being approved and legalized and stuff like that, and you're saying that we're maybe not that far away from that. What are some of the biggest challenges that are sort of standing in the way? I know that even people's perceptions is one, and it's looked at as a very negative thing. Talk to me a wee bit about the challenges that you and your team and the wider team face with trying to get this work legalized.
Yeah, so I suppose we're not on the politics side of it. You know, there's obviously an entire socio-political debate going on in wider society at the moment about the legalization of drugs. The Citizens Assembly that happened recently was a real litmus test of the public opinion, and understandably there's a lot of concern about the legalization of substances and the potential negative impact of recreational substance use for people's mental health and things like that, and for communities and crime and many other aspects as well. So we are kind of somewhat separate to that argument in that, you know, we're purely investigating the use of these substances for people's mental health, and we don't actually endorse people to use, you know, any illegal substances on a recreational basis. We hope to document whether this can help people with mental health difficulties, if that makes sense. And yeah, I think that there can be a lot of stereotypes that are that we're met with. You know, sometimes people can have a sense of like, oh God, I bet, you know, I bet all of you are really supportive of people taking drugs, for example. And you know, that isn't the case. And you know, we really are here for our patients, and we're trying to just trying to do our job and try to make a potential treatment more widely available. So yeah, I'm trying to think of any more challenges. It is challenging working in a trial environment, you know, like trying to, you know, you gain good relationships with people through this work, and people are understandably opening up a lot to us as a research team, and myself in particular, because I work with every patient. So it's hard then when things like there's a placebo, or say somebody doesn't pass screening and things like that. Like, that can be really challenging. But it is all in the name of the research, and that is what I say to every person who applies, and what I would say to anybody who's interested in applying, that taking part in these trials, nobody is guaranteed to make it through to the dosing day, but every person who contributes to the research is potentially furthering on the evolution of the treatments available. So I think it's, yeah, they're some of the main challenges I can think of now, Carla. The amount of paperwork in my daily life associated with this is a bit of a challenge, but it is also really necessary. You know, like, if I wasn't part of these trials and I heard that they were happening in Ireland or in Dublin, I'd be like, God, I hope they're being safe, you know. So, and I can really, I can really confidently say that we take every measure to be as safe as possible, and that means that we have to document everything that happens. So yeah, but I really enjoy the work, you know, like, by far the benefits and my enjoyment of the rollout outweigh any of those challenges. So yeah.
I don't know if this is going to sound a wee bit conspiracy theory or what, but
Yeah.
the psilocybin becoming illegal, there has been a lot of talk around that being, because the governments want to control us and they don't want us to reach these higher states of consciousness because of what we can achieve with our mind and all of that. What's your opinion on that?
Oh yeah, I think that's a really interesting question, actually. I know, like, nothing happens in a vacuum. Like, psychedelic substances, like, many of them were originally synthesized or isolated in labs, for example, you know, outside of ceremonial use, like, particularly in the States. If you look back at, you know, there's a whole host of documentaries on this kind of aspect of things, but even tying together the use of LSD, say, in the States, around the time of the Vietnam War, and there have been many reports of, you know, for example, the presidential campaign at the time to avoid people from listening to Timothy Leary, for example, tune in and drop out, that kind of thing. So again, all of this happened within context. And that's the thing again, is like, we're working in really scientific and controlled environments, but that isn't real life in a way. And I think that psychedelics can and do change the way that people see, think, and feel and interact with the world. So, whether or not there's been a purposeful effort to to control psychedelic drugs, because it might change people's minds too much, I really can't say. But it wouldn't be beyond the realms of possibility.
Okay, all right. So while we're on a good positive strike here, because then I do want to ask a wee bit more about risks and adverse reactions and stuff. But I wanted to ask you about the use of psychedelics and creativity. Because, a lot of people would, and I know that we're talking about this strictly in control environments and stuff like that, but a lot of people would feel very stuck in their life. And with if we're going to look at the science and the default mode network, not maybe different parts of the brain not connecting and stuff, then surely creativity is massively suppressed in people's lives and as a collective society as well. Can you talk to me about your experience in your work of psychedelics, psilocybin, and creativity? Is that something that you would look at?
Yeah, I think that's a really fascinating area. At the moment, we're not doing research on creativity, but it is something that I'm personally very interested in. And I think even on like a neuroscience level, it makes a lot of sense. And again, I'm not a neuroscientist, but thinking about how it connects different parts of the brain, it makes a lot of sense how our sense of colors are enhanced. And sometimes people report that for days afterwards. Like, it wouldn't be uncommon for, and this is again a bit of a stereotype, but, sometimes there might be an association between people who wear very bright colors, for example, and psychedelics or something like that.
I'm looking at your brightly orange scarf, your bright orange scarf.
Do like this color. I do like this color. But yeah, I think it is a fascinating area. There is a lot of research actually, and one thing that I think maybe not directly linked to creativity, but music and the psychedelic experience. It's, I think music can really guide a person's experience while they're under the influence of a psychedelic substance, for example. And I know that there's all sorts of research going on at the moment in terms of like what how specific genres of music might influence the psychedelic experience. And I do know, I've read anecdotal, things about people using specific microdose protocols for creativity and things like that. But I think something else that's really important to say on all of this, and not just about creativity, but the mental states that are induced by psychedelics can also be reached without taking any substance at all. Like, for example, the default mode network is also implicated in meditation, for example. And I think that sense of connection to ourselves, sense of connection to nature and others can be achieved without using any substances at all. So I just think that's worth saying in general. And particularly like, there are many different protocols for increasing creativity without using the substances. Like, for example, Rick Rubin has a very good book called The Creative Act, specifically on that topic. So yeah, just some interesting reading.
I'm glad you said that actually, because I mean, I suppose, yes, we've got the meditation. It just takes a lot longer to get there with it, with that modality. But I think that's a really important point. And I was going to ask you about books. So while we're on the topic, if there's any other areas. Any other books around this area, sorry, or articles or whatever, if you want to mention them, or if you can't think of any, just send them through and I'll put them in the notes of the episode, on Spotify and people can have a wee look. So what I want to just go back a couple of steps, and ask you around, some of the sort of concerns. I know that you've talked a wee bit about people who aren't suitable and stuff, but some of the risks, adverse reactions, around taking psilocybin, even if people are deemed to be fit for these trials, surely there's still a lot of risk or outcomes of adverse reactions. Would that be right?
There can be for some people. I know that in one published trial looking at psilocybin for people with depression, there was a small but not negligible subgroup of participants who reported an increase in thoughts about suicide, for example, or suicidal ideation. So that's taken very seriously, and again, that's something that we would assess our patients for, our participants for, on a regular basis. To check in around that, other adverse reactions. So I've mentioned about like potential psychosis, or loss of touch with the sense of reality. I've also mentioned manic episodes. There can also be just general psychological distress as well. Under like the purpose of a person coming for this treatment is because they want change in their lives. They want change in their behaviors. They want change in the way they feel. They want change in their symptoms. And sometimes that is really challenging. Like we were, talking earlier about how, to go about achieving change through meditation, for example, can take a long time. I have heard people compare psychedelics to like, oh, it's like 3 years of therapy in one session, but there's a good reason why therapy is undertaken, sorry, at a slow pace, because it's a lot. It's really a lot to process. And for example, sometimes imagine if there's a solution to a problem where there's something that needs to be processed and it's visualized by a door. Therapy, for example, or a more gentle intervention might show you the door, but it won't kick the door down. Some psychedelics will not only kick down the door, they'll push you through the door whether or not you want to go through it. And I'm talking about more strong psychedelics like, say, ayahuasca, 5-MeO-DMT, for example. Psilocybin can be forceful as well in terms of like sometimes. And this is something I do say to participants, like it's important to go in with an open mindset, because sometimes when we resist something that comes up in a psychedelic experience, it can actually enhance that subject that we're trying to avoid. So the way I describe that in a nutshell is, what you resist persists. And if someone is in a mindset where they're really not ready to face difficult things, those difficult things can get bigger and louder and stronger, and that can be really overwhelming now. And that is something that we do watch out for. Like we have to consider like how would we handle a situation where someone was completely overwhelmed. So again, that comes into safety protocols and things like that. So and then on the physical side, just to briefly talk about some of the other side effects, like sometimes people report nausea, particularly with psilocybin. I've heard that recreationally that can happen too. For example, if someone was to take mushrooms, and it is kind of interesting because, many of the medications that we would have for nausea, for example, it isn't necessarily safe to give them to someone who's taken a substance that also acts on chemicals in the brain, for example. So sometimes you have to get a little creative and maybe give somebody like lemon and ginger tea, for example, or something like that, or a peppermint, or but mostly it does seem that psilocybin is quite safe, and that the side effects are tolerable when careful screening is done, if that makes sense.
And how important is the intention when taking the psilocybin?
Yeah, I think that the intention is really, really important. It's all about set and setting. So just for anyone who might not have heard these terms before, set would refer to a person's mindset before taking a psychedelic substance. And that can include, like whether they're in a good mood or whether they're in a bad mood, or if, you know, if they're feeling anxious or concerned, or they need to talk about something and they haven't had a chance to, or if they're feeling anxious, for example. Other things would be the setting, so like the environment, and things like that. So all of those things are they can really influence the effect, or sorry, the experience of the person. So with that in mind, like taking psychedelics in an intentional way, it not only means like preparing your mind, but it also is being mindful of who's around you and who what environment are you in. And again, that ties really into, you know, I mentioned about Psych Care Ireland, for example. Like we regularly see people who would have taken a psychedelic and are overwhelmed. And a lot of the time it's because maybe they hadn't maybe thought through the potential impact of maybe they took more than they had originally planned to. So the dose, or maybe the set or the setting wasn't ideal. Maybe they were in an overwhelming environment, like a music festival is not always ideal, for example. Or maybe they just didn't have enough caring and supportive people around them at that time. So all of, and another thing that can come up as well is whether people are taking them with other substances as well, you know. And I think in terms of like negative effects of psychedelics, from a harm reduction point of view, you know, the only safe way to take substances recreationally is actually not to take them. But if someone is going to take them, it's really important to remind people that combining substances like alcohol with psychedelics, but particularly stimulants like cocaine and amphetamines, can be really they can increase the chances that someone might enter like a psychosis, for example. And then other things to bear in mind, like, you know, having enough sleep before essentially opening up your mind is really important, you know, not only for our ability to process, but our ability to tolerate any distressing stuff that comes up as well.
So having a clear intention, so setting the scene and setting the environment, going in with the mindset and actually sitting with the medicine and having an intention as to, you know, maybe there's an answer that people might be looking for with regards to, you touched earlier on relationship with parents or you know, stuff like that. Is that something that you ask people to do in trial, or are you speaking generally?
So speaking generally, I would have, you know, I believe that sometimes with the psychedelic experience, it's best to show up with, how do I say this? Cautious optimism for, you know, what's the word? Non-judgmental curiosity is the term that I find is the most applicable. So it's non-judgmental just means that you're not overly attached to where a trip or an experience might take you. And, you know, if something comes up and it's challenging, you're not immediately going like, oh, I can't handle this, or oh, this is too much, or oh, this, that, and the other. Similarly, you know, you just allow it to unfold. And the curiosity piece is about having an openness to explore whatever it is. So even if it is something that is very difficult, being able to notice your own reactions to these things can be really helpful, because it means that, you know, you're able to approach instead of resisting, which is something I touched on earlier. So to approach whatever comes up with non-judgmental curiosity is really important, because at the end of the day, like when someone has taken a psychedelic or another substance, and this is something that we try to support people with, you know, through in the trials, but also in my work with Psycare, is that, you know, if the person is otherwise physically well, trying to remind them that, like, look, you're in a safe place now and you've taken a substance and your body is actively metabolizing or breaking that down. So this experience will pass, but you just need to give it time. And once people hear that and realize that, they're often much more able to, yeah, allow the trip or the experience to unfold without necessarily resisting. And they're much more likely to have a growthful experience. And, you know, some people would describe, you know, oh, I had a bad trip, for example, and, within the trials and also in Psycare Ireland, we would try to reframe bad trips as challenging experiences, because a bad trip means like bad trip, full stop, the experience was bad. But challenging experience can be can teach us things. We it can be a springboard for growth and for learning, if that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds much better. Bad trip sounds very, very, very terrifying.
Yeah, and they can be, you know, challenging experiences can be incredibly terrifying, and you know, not to scare anybody, but there have been cases of people who have been really, like, their mental health's been incredibly challenged by psychedelic experiences. And again, that's why safety is so paramount. And you know, even though these substances are illegal, people are going to take them, and people are continuing to take them. So that's why I think that harm reduction is actually the most important approach, and information is really the most empowering thing. And the kindest thing that we can do is to actually offer people places when they're in need. In Psycare, for example, you know, we just sit with people, even though we know that, oh, they haven't this hasn't been prescribed by a doctor, and this isn't a lab setting. But it's like, okay, we don't judge. We're just like, you're here now, you need help. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you are a very amazing, and your work is very amazing. And I'm delighted to have been able to get you on and share some of this information. Let me ask you in maybe one short sentence.
I'm just laughing because my sentences are very long, so
Or one very long sentence or paragraph or whatever you want. What's your why for your work? What is your ultimate goal? Why do you do it?
in a nutshell, and this is literally the first thing that comes to my mind, it's to help someone, like anyone, to help someone like me, to help someone like you. Someone, you know, it could be like mental health doesn't discriminate, and yeah, that's why, really, Sinead, compassion,
Yeah.
empathy, love, science, a bit of nerdiness maybe thrown in as well.
nerdiness is always good, though.
Yeah.
That's great. Thank you so much, Kat, for your time.
No worries. Thanks so much, Carla. It's been an absolute pleasure.